Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers,
and from the law firm of Primer, Piper, Eggleston, and Kramer, providing comprehensive legal counsel to New Hampshire businesses and their owners for more than 30 years. For more information or to speak to an attorney, visit primer.com. And from the New Hampshire Department of Agriculture, Markets, and Food. New Hampshire's farms and farmers markets are full of fresh goods, rich with agricultural heritage, and available all year long. You can locate pick-your-own-farms, farmers markets, fairs, and more near you using the directories at visitnh.gov/agriculture.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Casey McDermott, and this is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on the Exchange. President Trump was back in New Hampshire this week, drawing thousands of supporters and some protesters to Manchester. Meanwhile, the candidates have mostly finished snacking on food on a stick at the Iowa State Fair, and they're coming back to New Hampshire in droves this weekend. We'll catch up on all the Democratic politics as well as they pour back into coffee shops, living rooms, libraries, and picnic pavilions. We'll also catch up about whether the First in the Nation campaign trail will keep picking up speed or whether this is all just a blip on the radar as candidates try to hustle for national support they need to qualify for the next round of debates. We'll also discuss whether Claremont is the new Dixville Notch, a bellwether for primary watchers. There's a lot to unpack from the campaign trail this week, so we're going to spend the entire hour on New Hampshire politics. And if you stick around, you might even get to hear a preview of NHPR's new podcast about the New Hampshire primary called Stranglehold. Stay right here with us for all of that on NHPR this morning. You can also stream this show live at nhpr.org, or if you'd like a glimpse behind the scenes of our live broadcast, head on over to Facebook Live at NHPR Exchange. We'd also love to hear from you if you have questions, comments about the week's news. Send those to NHPR Exchange on Twitter or exchange@nhpr.org by email. I'm really psyched for the panel of guests we have today. We have a ton of great political reporters with both local and national expertise joining us. On the line, we have Tamara Keith, NPR's White House correspondent and the host of the NPR Politics podcast. In the studio, I'm joined by my colleagues Josh Rogers, NHPR's senior political reporter, and Lauren Chulgin, NHPR political reporter for our State of Democracy project. Later on in the hour, we will hear from James Pindle, a political reporter with the Boston Globe. First, I think we're going to start with Tamara. I'd love to just kind of get a breakdown of last night's rally in Manchester and also hear a little bit about how that fits into what you're hearing on the national campaign trail. Tamara, thanks so much for joining us.
Yeah, so glad to be with you.
Sure. So what stood out to you from the president's rally in Manchester last night?
You know, in a lot of ways, it was a pretty standard rally. He stayed largely between the lines. Now, mind you, those are some pretty wide lines. The president really didn't go after the squad, for instance, as he has at some other rallies. He was, by his standards, quite tame on immigration. Now, of course, this was the first rally after those two mass shootings, and so maybe that is part of it. He did make it clear in the rally that he wants to win New Hampshire, that he intends to fix what the one that got away last time, as he sort of sees it. It was a very high energy rally. Certainly at the beginning, the cheers lasted a very long time when he came on stage. By the end, some folks were leaving, which often happens.
This was one of the longer speeches that he's given on the campaign trail in some time. Is that correct?
It was quite long. That's true. He has been giving longer and longer speeches. And you know, part of that, I think, is that there's a script that he's supposed to deliver, and then he embellishes, and that takes longer. He joked at one point that he wasn't saying Hillary Clinton's name. He kept saying my opponent. And then he did say her name once. And of course, chance of lock her up broke out. And then he started talking about the email server, and we relived 2016 a little bit. And then he joked like, oh gosh, well, maybe I should stop saying her name, otherwise we'll be here all night with these chants.
So it felt like a little bit of a throwback to 2016. Is that what I'm hearing?
It always does.
Yeah, yeah. So I want to follow up on some of the more specific issues that came up during this speech. You mentioned gun reform. Obviously, we're coming off of a week where we saw several pretty serious mass shootings across the country. Earlier, we heard from the president that he might be open to something along the lines of a new background check law, something like that. But it sounds like you're saying that he may have changed course a little bit in the speech last night.
Yes. And you know, we should be clear that this is something President Trump does. After Parkland, he was talking about wanting universal background checks and red flag laws. And then pretty quickly, that went away. And it seems like we're in the midst of that same cycle where right after the mass shootings, he said he tweeted he wanted strong background check legislation. And he also talked about these red flag laws to take guns away temporarily from people deemed to be a danger to themselves or others. He didn't mention any of that in the rally. He made no attempt to sort of rally his base behind these ideas. And instead, he focused more on mental health, which is something that he has done previously after mass shootings. And in particular, he delivered a line where he said, you know, guns don't pull the trigger, people pull the trigger. And it was this huge applause line. People who were sitting in the stands stood. It was a standing ovation. And the president clearly noted that response. You know, he's quite sensitive to those kinds of things. And applause is better than a poll for him in terms of getting a sense of what his base is feeling. He also got big applause when he talked about defending the Second Amendment. That is very different than what he had been talking about or the way he had been talking about it like a week and a half ago.
Could you elaborate on kind of how different that was?
Yeah, he had previously been clearly moving in the direction of wanting to talk about stronger background checks, had been making calls with Joe Manchin and Pat Toomey, the Democrat and Republican senator who had been working on background closing loopholes and background check laws going back to the Sandy Hook shooting. And so the president had at least been making signals that he wanted to try to do something. And his tone in the speech in the rally and also he was out on the tarmac as we were leaving to go to New Hampshire, and we kind of pressed him on it and asked him about background checks, and he kept dodging and weaving, not wanting to talk about background checks. It's clear that he's not in a hurry to go there. And what, you know, politicians on both sides of the aisle would tell you is that if the president isn't going to provide cover for Republicans and make a strong case for this, if he's going to sort of lean back and say, well, we'll see what happens, it's not going to happen.
Now, one of the other things that came up in the president's speech last night was the economy, and that was something that he brought up over and over and over again. And there's one line that seems to be getting a lot of pickup this morning in the coverage of the event, and that's the president saying that whether you love me or hate me, you've got to vote for me. And that was in the context of his assessment of the health of the economy right now. Did that stand out to you as well?
Oh, absolutely. And it stood out because he hasn't said it before in that way. And, you know, you talk to advisors to the president, you talk to supporters of the president again and again, they will tell you, oh, my gosh, he could tweet less. He could, you know, do some of these, be less crass and just talk about the economy. If you would just talk about the economy, then he could win re-election. It's the economy, stupid. You hear that again and again. But typically it's like he's bored talking about economic matters during his rally speeches. But in this rally, he kept coming back to it again and again. And the timing is puzzling, right? Because this is a week where the yield curve inverted, which is this, you know, sort of yellow light for potential down the road economic challenges. And the markets have been no good. Like, nobody wants to look at their 401k this week. Things have been very jittery for the stock market. And So for this to be the week where he's saying, you know, if I lose, your 401k is toast, is sort of odd. But in a way, when President Trump is concerned about something or focused on it, sometimes he compensates or overcompensates by talking about it more.
Well, yeah, I was just wondering, do you have a sense from his advisors of whether this is coming from a place of expectation that the economy is going to maybe turn around by the time the election comes around, that this is just a kind of temporary hiccup in the economy right now? Or is it, as you said, something that perhaps they are really worried about and they're just trying to get out ahead of it?
You know, it's not clear that. I mean, at the moment, the economy is still really good. Let's be clear. The
right.
unemployment rate is very low. Now, there are lots of people who don't feel like their personal economy is good. And a lot of that is related to health care costs and other things. So there is no recession right now. I think that the president wants to will it to be that there will never be a recession. It's not clear exactly what they're doing with this, but I think part of it is that he feels like, or I don't know what he feels, but part of it is that he seems to be trying to just say everything is great. No, really, everything is great, in hopes that that will counteract some unfortunate headlines.
Now, you cover the Trump White House as well as covering the campaign. Are there any themes that you're seeing cross over from your coverage of the administration onto the campaign trail in a really meaningful way outside of the economy?
I don't think that there's a really big distinction between the campaign and governing, because for President Trump, everything is political and everything is about winning. So the distinctions are, and also he's been running for re-election ever since he took office. So the distinctions are not as clear. You know, like earlier this week, he went to Pennsylvania for an official speech about energy independence and, the energy, oil and natural gas industry. And what happens? It basically turns into a campaign speech where he's criticizing his Democratic opponents as potential opponents. So the distinctions are hard to find.
So actually that reminds me, I wanted to ask you a little bit about, you've followed the president around to all kinds of different states across the country, to Florida, to Michigan, to Ohio. Is there much distinction between what you're hearing in other states versus what came up in the speech in New Hampshire last night? Was there a lot of local detail added in, or was it mostly kind of a stock set of remarks that you might have heard elsewhere?
It was mostly stock remarks that you would have heard elsewhere, though he did on a number of occasions toss out specific New Hampshire unemployment numbers or manufacturing numbers, things like that. He also said something very strange, and I don't have the exact quote, but it was like, you were poster children for, like industrial decay or
the closing of
factories.
Was it that one?
Yes. And it seemed like kind of a weird thing to say.
Yeah, I mean, there are certainly parts of the state that have seen closures in their manufacturing industry here, like has been the case across other parts of the country where, in particular, where the president did well in 2016.
In the upper Midwest.
And I think one of the other things that I thought was really interesting was this week you also had a story about how the Trump campaign is kind of setting its sights on states like New Hampshire. I think Minnesota was one of the other ones that they've singled out as places that they didn't win in 2016, but that they're hoping to capture in 2020. And I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about what you heard from members of the campaign and what that might tell us about how their strategy might be different in 2020 versus 2016.
Right. So in 2016, President Trump is President Trump because he won Wisconsin, Michigan, and Pennsylvania. Those are states that have traditionally been Democratic states. He won them very narrowly. I mean, the combined total was less than 80,000 votes that he won those three states by. So the campaign is looking to expand the map. They they are definitely trying to win those states again. They don't want to lose those states again. But they also are building in some insurance, you would say, by trying to win in the states that they've named are New Hampshire, Minnesota, Nevada, Colorado, and New Mexico. Now, whether they are truly serious about all of those states, I'm not sure. New Hampshire is the first one, the first state that he didn't win, where he's holding a campaign rally this year. And I think that is notable. New Hampshire was also the state that he lost most narrowly.
Got it. And, the president did come within a pretty tight margin here in 2016. It was only a few thousand votes. So that has been, I think, a subject of great debate among the parties here in the years since is how winnable it might be heading into 2020. This is a little bit of a curveball, but I do think it's interesting mm-hmm. and important to clear up. We got a question from a listener, Ray in Dalton, who asked if this was a campaign rally, who was responsible for paying the expenses for travel, for security, and for things like that. Tam, do you have a sense of how that usually breaks down?
I know the answer to this question
because
I'm working on a story about this right now. Thank you, listener. I could have planted that question.
Wonderful.
So the answer is that the campaign is supposed to reimburse the Treasury for the use of Air Force One and other expenses to get to the rally. The campaign obviously pays for the arena. My understanding is that the city of Manchester is not planning to charge the campaign for security expenses, for police expenses in Manchester. Some cities have charged the campaign, others have not. And our reporting indicates that some cities have not been paid back. Now, the exact formula for how much the Treasury is reimbursed for the use of Air Force One and other things like that is not clear. It's a little bit of a black box, and it's not just Trump. Past presidents have also, they just don't release the formula, so they don't say how it's calculated. But if you look in, the campaign finance reports from the Trump campaign, you will see money owed or money paid to the U.S. Treasury, and that's what it's for.
Well, thanks so much for filling that in for us on a national level. And I should give a shout out here, too, to my colleague Sarah Gibson, who covers the southern part of the state for NHPR. She did a story that you can find on NHPR.org about just what you were talking about, Tam, regarding the city of Manchester's plans not to seek reimbursement from the president's campaign for the rally that we saw there this week. I guess just looking ahead, obviously, I think here in New Hampshire, it can easily feel like the election is always just kind of a day away. But we really have a long way to go. And I wonder what you will be watching for or what you're most curious to follow in the months between now and November 2020.
Well, one thing that I am paying attention to as relates to New Hampshire and some of these other states that the campaign says that they intend to win is whether they are really campaigning in those states. And you actually very kindly connected me with some Republican activists and leaders in New Hampshire who told me, yeah, they are campaigning. The Trump campaign has staff on the ground, and local Republican club meetings are more populated than they normally would be this far out. And that the Trump campaign is more sophisticated this time around than they ever were in 2016. I'm sort of watching the president's travel schedule. Is he only going to New Hampshire, or is he going to go to Minnesota, or is he going to start going to Arizona? Those are the kinds of things that I'm watching for.
Well, great. We will look forward to following all of your reporting from the campaign trail in the months ahead. Thanks so much for making time for us. I know it's been a crazy week for you.
Absolutely.
Have a good day. Take care. Thanks. And we will come right back after the break with more from NHPR's Lauren Shulgin and Josh Rogers for the local perspective on President Trump's rally in Manchester last night and the rest of the news from New Hampshire's campaign trail. Stick with us right here on NHPR. We'll be right back.
Support for the Exchange podcast from NHPR comes from you, our subscribers, and from
Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit providing college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org or by calling 1-855-887-5430.
This is the weekly news roundup on NHPR. I'm here in the Exchange studios with Lauren Chulgen and Josh Rogers, both my colleagues on the political team here at New Hampshire Public Radio. Thank you both for joining me this morning. I know it was a late night.
We are so honored to be here for your first day.
Thank you so much. I wouldn't have it any other way.
Josh is so psyched.
I can tell that just
by
looking at him.
No one can hear you nodding, Josh.
Yes. Well, we have a lot to talk about today because
obviously
the president was in Manchester last night. There's also a lot happening on the campaign trail outside of that rally in Manchester. Lauren, I want to throw it to you first because I know you spent a lot of time outside just kind of roaming the perimeter, talking to people. Mm-hmm. I want to get a sense for just what the scene was like for people who might not have been downtown.
Yeah, so for anyone, which I feel like is most of us now that's seen any of these rallies on television, whether it's in the states that Tam just mentioned or the one here, I mean, it looks just like you imagine. It's a long, long line of thousands and thousands of people, lots of Make America Great Again hats, winding around a big arena. I mean, the only difference this time is that it was Elm Street. It was the auto shops that we all drive by when we're driving down through Manchester's downtown. And then there were a lot of Red Sox shirts, you know, so there were some distinctions there. And then, you know, they were our neighbors this time. And so I think it's kind of a rock concert vibe, I have to say. I mean, if anyone's driven downtown Manchester during like a big concert, it's a similar vibe, but just many, many more people. And, you know, there are vendors selling Trump gear. There's shirts, hats, flags, the whole nine yards. And I think the overall feeling is just people are so psyched to be there. I mean, before, you know, you see a lot on TV, and I'm sure Josh will talk about this, about how, like, once people get very hyped up in the arena, there's sometimes some anger or the chanting that you hear a lot about. But beforehand, it's like people are finally getting to see their favorite band. I mean, I had a guy, Keith Rinaldi from Derry, tell me like he had a greatest hits he was hoping to hear. He wanted to hear the president bash the media, bash Democrats, and come up with new nicknames for his opponents. We didn't get any new nicknames, but I think we can rest assured Keith Rinaldi got a lot of that bash the media, bash Democrats thing he was looking for. And honestly, like, what I heard the most, and sometimes didn't even have to ask for, was people saying to me that they felt a need to defend the president, especially that they hear a lot of people criticizing him, saying that he uses racist language or is racist. You know, we've heard Democratic candidates for president call him a white supremacist. And I didn't even have to ask. Melissa Hayes from Massachusetts, she was there with three of her girlfriends. And she would just, and so would her friends, just rush to the president's defense, feeling the need to protect him.
You know, I think things that he says sometimes don't come out the way they're intended with him. I think he just speaks from his cuff, in his heart. But I mean, I've watched Donald Trump for 30 plus years, and never was he a racist. He was a womanizer.
Yeah, sure.
But he was never a racist until he ran for president. And to me, it's disgusting the way that I feel like he's the most harassed person in the universe.
And it should never happen to another United States president again. You know? Just like you said, what they've done to this man and his family, he didn't have to take this job.
Well, first, of course, he didn't just take the job. He was elected, of course. But, you know, point taken. And I think this is something I heard from many people, that they think that this criticism that he's racist or using racist language is an election stunt. They think it's just another thing on the campaign trail. Of course, many people would dispute that. And there's many connections being made about the kind of language he uses, about the Latino population and the shootings that we saw in Texas. And so, you know, it was, for me, I had never covered a Trump rally before. I've only been to the Republican National Convention, which, you know, had a similar vibe to it. But it was certainly, for anyone who wasn't there and was interested about it, it was pretty much what you see on TV. And that's kind of like what we heard from Tam, too, right? That it was the standard rally we always get.
Yeah. And just to kind of drill in a little bit more on the actual crowd, mm-hmm. did you get a sense for kind of the age, maybe the racial breakdown of the crowd?
So I would say overall, it was was white for sure, mostly middle-aged, older age, I would say. I mean, there were certainly, you know, kids there. I saw high school students, college students. It is hard to get a real, like, percentage grasp when there's that many thousands of people. I mean, these are really big crowds that we're talking about. But unquestionably, mostly white. And I was surprised that, although Josh gave me the heads up that he thought this was going to be the case, so good for you for knowing that. But there were mostly a lot of people from Massachusetts. I mean, a lot of people who came up saying, you know, I had a couple who said they were on vacation and they are big fans of Donald Trump. They wanted to see, you know, the energy they had seen on TV. There was a lot of discussion of this as like a cultural experience that people who are fans of the president first and foremost wanted to say, listen, I'm here to support him. But they also really felt like, you know, this looked like a fun thing and they wanted to be a part of it. And the other thing I would say about people from Massachusetts that I talked to, I mean, I heard, you know, maybe like 10 people at some stage say to me that, you know, Massachusetts is, of course, much more left-leaning state. We're a much more purple state here. And to be able to come to a Trump rally, Melissa Hayes, who you heard, was one of the people who said, I feel like I can actually be open about my feelings and not feel like I'm isolating myself by being a fan of President Trump. So clearly this was not a place where you would be isolated for that opinion.
Yeah, it definitely sounds like there were a lot of people that were drawn there because they were hoping that it would be kind of a communal event.
Yes, absolutely.
There were a lot of people expressing their feelings for the president and for the political moment. You know, I do think that in a lot of ways this was like rallies of 4 years ago, although Donald Trump is now president.
Right.
That changes it a good deal. And, you know, what we heard inside was in some ways sort of a mashup of, you know, the very loud, and this was loud. They were actually passing out earplugs before the event, and I decided not to take them because I'd never seen this before, and it was the loudest rally I've ever been to. I mean, the Verizon Center apparently holds 12,000 people. It was close to being full, and you know, as Tamara indicated, you know, President Trump seemed to be very happy to get on stage, and then once on stage, very happy to bask in what was a lot of cheering. I mean, I think it was, you know, over 3 minutes where he just stood, you know, sort of acknowledging the applause he was receiving. And, you know, while he toggled through, you know, kind of the greatest hits that Lauren indicated some of his supporters wanted to hear, in some ways, what he did was a little bit more conventionally political. He focused on the economy in a way that an incumbent president hoping to get reelected might do. He also acknowledged folks from New Hampshire in a way that was a little new. He mentioned legislative leaders. He certainly mentioned core supporters from last campaign who were, you know, more marginal politically than they now are. I mean, Steve Stepanek, who was his one of his state chairmen, he's now chair of the GOP. You know, his two current campaign chairmen, Al Baldessaro and Fred Doucette, certainly, you know, familiar names in kind of Trump world and around the state house. You know, they were noted from the stage. You know, Governor Chris Sununu, who has had an interesting relationship with the Trumps and the Sununu family, was making the scene. He was actually signing some Make America Great hats and posing for selfies. He wasn't on stage as you might have a governor on stage, but, you know, President Trump was quick to praise him and his father.
Yeah, I thought that was especially interesting, having watched the 2016 campaign. Obviously, we saw kind of an evolution of the entire, or many, in the New Hampshire Republican Party during that campaign, where at the beginning, the governor's father, former governor John Sununu, was opposed to Trump, like many Republicans were, and eventually came around. And I think we have some tape of the president actually making reference to that during his speech last night.
With a great father. His father was tough. Chris, your father was so tough. He was for somebody else in the primaries. And then one by one, I won here, I won there, I won there. And then when I won, his father got on. I said, oh, this guy kills me. He's so tough. And he said, President Trump will be the greatest of all time. I said, what happened? What happened? He went from being the toughest critic to the best there is. So I want to say hello to your father. Okay, Chris, you'll tell him. Great guy. What a family. What a family. Thank you, Chris.
So again, that is President Trump. President Trump, what a family. And that's quite a different tune than we heard the president and the Sununu family singing.
By the end of the campaign, when former Governor John H. Sununu, you know, kind of got on board with Trump, you know, there was sort of public fond feeling expressed. However, you know, truly sincere, we don't know. But, you know, Chris Newton has been interesting in his relationship with the Trump administration. He's, you know, at times been quite, you know, enthusiastic in his praise of the president. He's claimed that his good relationships with the administration, be it with Betsy DeVos, be it with, you know, people in the energy and interior segment of the cabinet, have meant good things for New Hampshire. And, you know, he's in a position where, and other Republicans are too, where, you know, they're going to be running with Trump. How they navigate that, you look at some other states, people like Charlie Baker, Phil Scott, adjacent Republican governors have been a lot more critical of President Trump than Chris Sununu has. And, you know, I was interested to see if he showed up. And, you know, there he was, along with, you know, Senate President Chuck Morse was there, who also is not really naturally a kind of Trump sort of Republican. Education Commissioner Frank Edelblum was also kind of working the room a bit. It was,
don't forget Dick Hinch.
Who could forget Dick Hinch? He got praise from the stage.
Big
and
shout
was
out.
Wearing a red hat. He
and I believe it was
cheerful.
The Keep America Great hat.
Yes,
not
it was.
The Make America
yes,
Great Again hat.
Josh got a pick of that. I have to say too, like, that will not be the first, that will not be the last time we hear that clip. I mean, I feel like, and I'm sure you feel the same way, that I felt like I could hear the New Hampshire State Democratic Party, like, interns fingers quickly typing away. I mean, the State Democratic Party has been trying for years to, since Trump was elected, to connect Governor Sununu with President Trump for political purposes, to say to people who are on the fence, listen, if you don't like Donald Trump, maybe you wouldn't like Governor Sununu. And you know, whether the connection is as strong as they have put it out there to be, moments like that where the president does call him out by name are certainly moments that we will see them reiterate on the campaign trail.
You know, another interesting thing was how the president handled the potential Senate candidacy of Corey mm-hmm. Lewandowski of New Hampshire, who was, of course, Donald Trump's campaign manager through the primaries until he was sort of unseated by Paul Manafort. You know, Corey Lewandowski and his family apparently met the president when he arrived. You know, the president, you know, stopped short of endorsing Lewandowski's run, but said, you know, he'd be a strong candidate and would serve New Hampshire well, and said essentially, like, Corey's going to have to talk it over with his family. But he was also there last night working the room. Interestingly, you know, another person in the 2020 Senate race, retired Brigadier General Don Bolduc, was also down there. Mm-hmm. You know, I spoke with him a little bit. I mean, he's, you know, trying to cast himself as his own man, but, you know, he's cognizant of you're running in a primary where you don't have much name recognition, and you're running an election season where Trump's going to be at the top of the ticket.
He had signs everywhere. He's certainly trying to hustle where he can.
Well, it's interesting because, you know, as you noted in the governor's race and mm-hmm. certainly in Governor Sununu's administration, he has walked a pretty delicate line, but has been generally, I think, supportive of the president.
Definitely.
For the reasons that you mentioned. And now we're starting to see a U.S. Senate race take mm-hmm. shape where it seems as though the Republicans that either are declared or potentially going to run are kind of just trying to position themselves as who can be the most close to the president, or what we're seeing, for example, to some degree with regard to, for example, declared candidate former House Speaker Bill O'Brien. Shortly after the president's rally wrapped up last night, we saw a statement from him put out saying that he was the only Republican candidate, declared or undeclared, who's actually won elections in New Hampshire. He's touted his close ties to the president all along the way. But now with the potential looming candidacy of Corey Lewandowski, I'm curious to hear your thoughts on the dynamic that might set up between those two candidates in particular.
Well, I mean, certainly the conventional thinking would be that Corey Lewandowski would be well positioned to tap into the national network of Trump donors and supporters. He certainly brings a higher name ID right. nationally than these other people, arguably in the state, although Bill O'Brien is certainly very well known among conservative voters in New Hampshire. You know, for all of these people, it's about kind of going where the action is. And 10,000 plus Trump voters. You know, I don't know how many of them. You know, there was a good slug of them from Massachusetts, but there were a lot of voters. If you were running in a Republican primary,
you'd want
to be there with them. And
the question, though, remains, though, how big is the sliver of Republicans who are moderate, who feel that they either voted for the president, regret it, or didn't vote for him, didn't vote, whatever, or feel that he's not their guy? What do they do in a local race like that? We had a lot of people in the last midterm election who split ticket, right? They considered a Chris Pappas for Congress, but they went for Chris Sununu for governor. And I think that is the ultimate question for me when I think about these things, is that we know that there's a segment of the Republican Party out there. The question is how many of those people there are and if they would even have a sway in an election like that. And
the flip side of that is on the how many Democrats out there who, you know, would vote Democrat for whoever the nominee is, but might support Chris Sununu. And that was something that the Democrats were holding events earlier this week going after Trump and going after Sununu. And I was talking to one of the people affiliated with the event. And I said, well, you know, what are you really hoping to get out of this event? And I was told, well, you know, the bottom line is we really need straight ticket voting if we want to defeat Governor Sununu. We need people to vote Democrat all the way down. And, you know, we believe linking him to President Trump will be helpful in that regard.
Again, I reiterate, we will hear that clip again, like, for sure.
I think for the reasons Josh mentioned, definitely we saw Governor Sununu, you know, cruise pretty smoothly into re-election because he's enjoyed generally favorable ratings among not only Republicans, but among independents and Democrats as well. So I think that certainly provides some more context for understanding why the Democratic Party might be so eager to try to link him to the president.
Well, and, we're right now coming off a season where he's vetoed 50 plus bills. Mm-hmm. You know, he started off the legislative season, inaugurated with a divided legislature, as you know, one might, saying, you know, the voters here clearly sent us to Concord to work together. You know, how well he and Democrats have worked together is obviously kind of in the eye of the beholder. But you know, we don't have a budget yet. He's vetoed 50 plus bills. More vetoes to come. You know, he seems to have gone kind of all in on this. I am going to defend New Hampshire values as I see them in the face of what he's cast as kind of Democratic extremism. That certainly puts him closer to the Republican base than he might have been otherwise. And, you know, it's kind of, you've got to kind of dance with the people who brought you. We'll see. It's a long ways to election.
We will keep watching for that dancing. I guess just any other kind of local issues of interest or local kind of greatest hits lines of interests that you noticed or picked up on during the president's speech?
Well, it was interesting. He seemed to try to make New Hampshire kind of a case in point for various policy priorities of his. He talked about, you know, the drug issues here in the context of a border wall. He talked about, you know, manufacturing job loss. And, you know, while manufacturing jobs do make there's a lot of manufacturing in New Hampshire, you know, the hemorrhaging of jobs has not necessarily been recent.
And he also mentioned the high employment rate, or the low unemployment rate.
Yeah, and he said,
rather,
you know, he said, I'd like to take credit for that. He said, it's going to be a record. And that was one moment where he, you know, heaped a little bit of praise on the governor. So he did try to cast his economic message in a specifically New Hampshire way.
Mm-hmm. Lauren, was there anything else that really stood out to you last night?
I mean, I guess I'd just go back to the point Josh was making earlier, where like some of the names that we hear the president uttering are not the names of the political Republican establishment, you know, that you might have thought we would have heard in any other election with any other president. And it just goes to show the power of New Hampshire, right? I mean, you can elevate somebody who was just a state senator, state representative for a few years and now is sitting in this big arena with thousands of people and the president's calling your name. I mean, it was...
Or the lack of the power of the perceived political
or
establishment.
Exactly. Josh, well, I love working with you.
Hold that thought, because we are going to talk a lot more about that power, perceived or real, coming up after the break. Stay tuned for a preview of our upcoming podcast about the New Hampshire primary. We'll be right back here at NHPR.
I'm Nina Totenberg. Are you someone who talks about how great public radio is, but you're still not a donor? Rather than wait for the next pledge drive, you can support the programs you love by donating that unwanted vehicle. It could be worth hundreds of dollars to this station, and you could get a tax deduction. Or you could just give us hundreds of dollars directly. We'd like that a lot. And thank you.
Learn more about donating your old car or truck at nhpr.org/cardonation.
We are back for the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. And before we get moving with the news of the week, I want to take a step back. Obviously, we've been talking a lot about New Hampshire primary politics. And I want to bring back in my colleague Lauren Chulgen to talk a little bit about a special project that we've been working on here at NHPR about the primary.
Yes, I actually was thinking I haven't been on the exchange in quite some time. And the
this
reason
is a perfect
for that
time
is
to come back.
Because we've been working on a podcast. Maybe listeners have noted we've been all working on many podcasts. Taylor Quimby's great podcast, Patient Zero, just dropped this week. But we on the politics team have been working on a project we're calling Stranglehold. It's a podcast about how the New Hampshire primary kind of came to be this powerful institution, how New Hampshire has had such a tight grip on this thing for so many years, how it came to be that we're first. And Casey, you know, you had done this great survey of listeners. We hear from people all the time, and you know better than anybody, one of the biggest questions that we got was, why are we first? So people who live here still have those questions. And so we figured there's so many people talking about the election right now. There's so many reporters talking about the candidates for 2020 and how many million there are of them. And we decided the best way to take a different look was to look at what we could talk about more uniquely than anyone else, and that is our institution, the New Hampshire primary, where it came from.
And let's just pause for a minute. You said the name is Stranglehold.
Yes,
it
is.
Can you just unpack that very briefly?
It is also a Ted Nugent song, for the record. Stranglehold is a word that evokes, you know, a lot of energy, a lot of aggression. And I think there's a dispute, depending on who you ask, about you know, how we grip this power and what we do when people try to take it away from us. And so that was kind of the story we wanted to dig into, is what are the kinds of things that New Hampshire has had to do to keep this thing? And it's also a word that, through many, 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 many hours of clip searching that I've done about the history of the primary, that some of our critics have used when people, whether it's an old columnist for the New York Times or whether it's former Senator Carl Levin of Michigan, who have said, we don't like this process, we don't want New Hampshire to be first. That's the term that's been used to say, it seems like this little state's got a stranglehold over this process.
Okay, well, let's take a listen about what that podcast has to tell us about the primary.
There's a story New Hampshire likes to tell about its famous presidential primary. The story goes that this state makes better presidents.
This is a state that asks candidates to come and look people in the eye and shake the hand and to share the heart. And I like that kind of campaigning.
That if you want to be president, you better spend a lot of time here.
I think winning New Hampshire to me would be a tremendous honor.
That the New Hampshire primary is democracy at its finest.
Your voice can change the outcome of the New Hampshire election. Your choice can choose the next leader of the free world.
That's a nice story, but we're going to tell you a different one. A story about power and what people will do to keep it. A story about how a state that's much smaller and way whiter than other states gets the first crack at picking presidents. Because here's a secret. Here in New Hampshire, we know how valuable this thing is, how much power it gives us. We're not giving that up.
Basically, it came down to this. I'm just going to cut to the chase. This is we're New Hampshire, and I don't give a shit about Iowa.
This is a story about petty fights.
He pointed to me and said, you tell me I'm not acting in good faith, you're not acting in good faith.
And confusing arguments.
He referenced Mussolini, like he talked about Mussolini for maybe 5 minutes.
About people who tried to challenge the status quo.
Take a look at these quotes. I will pledge to the death to protect the New Hampshire primary, so help me God. It's a reality we gotta change.
And people who cling to tradition for dear life.
You might think that it's not fair that one state goes first all these times. Well, it's maybe not fair that A is the first letter of the alphabet or Sunday's the first day of the week.
Coming in September from New Hampshire Public Radio, Stranglehold, a podcast about what happens when one small state gets its hands around our presidential elections and won't let go.
The most important thing that we can do is to save the New Hampshire primary, because without the primary, what is New Hampshire?
So that was our trailer. Faithful listeners to NHPR will have recognized a few voices there. So I am co-hosting the podcast with my colleague Jack Rodolico. And as we said there in the trailer, it comes out in September. We have a couple episodes that we're really hustling on to get that to you as soon as possible. And the goal here is just for listeners here and elsewhere to just take a step back and think about this New Hampshire institution, this national institution, and what it means for our election process. And I don't know, to just look at it in a new way instead of just a tradition that we all just kind of assume as normal.
And got to give a special shout out there as well to our multi-talented colleague, Jason Moon.
Who played the music.
You may not know is the person behind those sick guitar riffs.
That's right.
There. So tune in for lots of NHPR voices and lots of NHPR talents behind your earbuds coming soon. Someone else who's been taking a pretty close look at the institution and the future of the New Hampshire primary is our next guest, the Boston Globe's James Pindle. James, thanks so much for being with us this morning. We really appreciate it.
Nice to talk with you, Casey.
Yeah. So I guess just to start off, I'm curious to hear your take. I know you've written kind of a series of stories over the last few months looking at various, I think of them as kind of inflection points in the New Hampshire primary. What do you make of the role that New Hampshire will play in 2020 or is playing in 2020 right now?
Well, I mean, in the early stages, this is not a primary that we typically think of when it comes to the tradition and the history. Jimmy Carter walking around, introducing himself at Robey's Country Store, and the store owner says, "Who? Jimmy who?" These classic ideas that you can come from nowhere, be the small little guy, and emerge into something because you connected with the state's voters or you had the best ideas. You can go down the line. Gary Hart, John McCain, you know, took on the establishment because he really connected with the folks. That story is not playing out right now. We can talk about a collection of reasons, but unlike the way the premise of the podcast was, this is not a state. It's not Michigan coming after New Hampshire or Florida or California or something like that. This is much more about existential issues with the primary in terms of the rise of social media. What does an endorsement really mean if I don't need you to have a house party to serve as a gatekeeper to invite the right people, because I, as a candidate, can just identify with metadata the exact people I want to reach, and I reach them on an email or on a Facebook ad. But at the end, I think the primary will remain as important as it always has. Again, this is when we get down to the actual voting, which we think is going to be in February. In that case, we still have a number of candidates running for president, and if they do not do well in Iowa and New Hampshire, it's probably game over.
So one of the things that you mentioned just there is that in past cycles, the threat to New Hampshire's primary has come largely in the form of other states that were trying to kind of jump in front of the Granite State in the primary calendar. The thing this time around that is really posing a pretty significant threat, if you want to call it that, to the primary seems to be the role of cable news and of national news coverage and the importance of that as it relates to debate qualifications or just getting your name out there. Could you talk a little bit about what you're seeing there on the campaign trail?
That's right. You know, so in the previous times, it was if you did well in Iowa or New Hampshire, you got a little something going. Howard Dean, for example, great example. In 2002, 2003, spent a considerable amount of time, particularly in New Hampshire, working it. And then, hey, he's upticking in the polls. Something's happening here. Then the national media will come in. You'll be like, there's something going on with Howard Dean. Then it sort of feeds upon itself. It's a virtuous cycle. Now he's able to raise more money because more people are talking about it. He's got more buzz. And then he continues to go up. Obviously, it crashed down. But the same thing with John Kerry. Got a little something going on in Iowa. Then we can see him and watch him come back and defeat Howard Dean. This time, it's the other way around. I literally have staffers in New Hampshire for presidential campaigns telling me, I mean, look, these campaigns are flush with cash, but they're saying we're just waiting for a viral moment that happens largely on cable news. Pete Buttigieg is one of the most remarkable stories of this campaign in terms of how he came from the mayor of South Bend to a top-tier contender for president of the United States. And that began on a CNN town hall meeting in Austin, Texas. It had nothing to do with New Hampshire. And one of the most mind-boggling articles recently to talk about the tradition of New Hampshire was there's a Buffalo News article, and you have to stay with me for a second, but you know they're doing these classic stories, what's going on with our home state Senator Kirsten Gillibrand and her presidential campaign. They come to New Hampshire, they follow around on a bus tour where she's doing everything you're supposed to do in New Hampshire. Show up early, often, shake hands, have a personal connection, answer everyone's questions. They follow this woman, that Kirsten Gillibrand meets. So what do you think of the senator from New York? She said, oh, she's fine, but I'm really into Pete Buttigieg. And they said, oh, why? She said, well, I heard him on some national podcast. It's sort of jarring. I mean, the person is literally in front of your face, answering your questions, probably agrees with you on everything, asking you literally for your vote. But what got her on to Pete Buttigieg was how he performed on a national podcast. So there is something definitely changing in that role. And you have candidates now deciding not to come to New Hampshire the last minute if they get a great cable news invitation, as Marianne Williamson just did a couple weeks ago. There's something going on here in terms of process that voters may not be paying attention to, but it is hugely significant in terms of the clout that the state typically has and what we're used to seeing.
Well, totally.
And we talk about it more often.
Yeah, yeah. And that's definitely something that, having been out on the campaign trail in 2016, was notable, seeing candidates like, for example, former New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, who was also doing it, quote unquote, the New Hampshire way, who ended up not having a super stellar showing here. But I want to follow up on something related to South Bend Mayor Pete Buttigieg, because it relates to another piece that really caught my eye that you did recently. And I'm just going to present the kind of tagline on this. It was about the Claremont primary, and it says, "Move over, Dixville Notch. A new bellwether emerges." Could you just talk a little bit about what you're getting at there?
Yeah, this is a column for New Hampshire Magazine, and the premise was that if you pay attention to what's happening in this cycle, a lot of candidates really like going to Claremont. Claremont is not easy to get to, as a lot of people know in the state, but it has an outsized influence. If you look at major American states like, say, Arizona, which is an emerging swing state, obviously a very key place on the hotbed of immigration, 5 times larger than the state population of New Hampshire, but they aren't getting nearly as many visits. In fact, they have just one visit. After I wrote the column, Elizabeth Warren visited there. And meanwhile, Claremont is like the sort of hotbed. And part of the reason is it's sort of a litmus test. They're not even a litmus test, but sort of a harbinger of what how campaigns can compete. You know, the number one question Democrats are asking when you go to these rallies is not whether they like the candidate. It's whether they think the candidate can beat Donald Trump. And in Claremont, it's a really interesting test. It's historically a very Democratic city and a very Republican state. Clearly, politics have changed in the state and in the country. And for the first time in anyone's memory, Claremont no longer voted Democratic in 2016. They voted for President Trump. And it's sort of in line with what's happening in Michigan and in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin, other traditional Democratic states. And so you may have a split screen where one candidate stands on the stage and says, I'm so happy I won the New Hampshire primary. And yet another candidate will make the electability argument saying, yeah, I didn't win New Hampshire, but I won Claremont. And that's why I'm the best positioned to beat Donald Trump. And so you had a number of candidates already spending a considerable amount of time there.
Yeah. And just on that note, we, of course, heard former Ohio Governor John Kasich in 2016 making much out of his big win in Dixville Notch, despite the fact that he might not have necessarily won New Hampshire. But he, of course, came in second place, and that catapulted him at least for a little bit longer in the primary that time around. So it's going to be a pretty busy weekend on the campaign trail here. James, where will you be? What will you be watching?
Well, you know, there's going to be a lot of activity. I think one person that is kind of raising some eyebrows is New York entrepreneur Andrew Yang, who will be doing a stretch through the state. He is someone who is now qualified for the debate stage over governors and senators and members of Congress. He's rising in national polls. He's raising a lot more money. it'd be interesting to see where this is actually headed and if he thinks New Hampshire is a sort of a beachhead for him where he wants to make a mark. But Cory Booker, of course, is another person who, you know, is doing the traditional New Hampshire campaigning. I don't think we've seen a candidate this cycle spending so much time actively seeking out endorsements from state senators and state representatives and major activists. He's putting in the traditional work. Meanwhile, his poll numbers still have not elevated him to the top tier whatsoever. He has built something there that if he has a moment, he could probably grab it more than other candidates can. But for all the candidates coming in, I think those are the two I'm really watching. Steve Bullock, of course, the governor of Montana, is also in the state, but he's kind of putting more emphasis on Iowa right now. So I think those are the two that I'll be really kind of paying attention to.
And this is, of course, a crucial final sprint before that debate qualification cutoff at the end of this month for the September debates. Thanks so much, James, for making time for us. I know it's a pretty busy time for you, as it is for lots of political reporters right now. So we appreciate it.
It's a lot of fun. Good job hosting the show today.
Thank you. Well, Lauren, Josh, thank you for being here as well. What else will you guys be keeping an eye out for the campaign in the months ahead?
In the months ahead, I mean, I got my eyes on that New Hampshire primary relevance story. I'm right there with James that seeing and identifying what the threats are to our first in the nation status, if there are any, and if it's not a state, and you know, if it's CNN or what have you, I'll certainly be watching that. And I'm also always got my eyes on Republicans. It's part of my beat here, and seeing if Bill Weld makes any more appearances or seeing how Republicans in New Hampshire are splitting, what percentage is a base Trump supporter, what is not.
We also had Mark Sanford floating presidential challenge.
So I'll certainly have my eyes on that. What about you, Josh?
I mean, my horizons are more limited in the near term. I'm going to be out over the weekend seeing some of these candidates, some of the ones James mentioned. And, you know, there are several others who will be in the state who are kind of, you know, on the bubble in terms of their viability moving forward. There are going to be a bunch of them at a Democratic picnic over in Greenfield, the same picnic 1 year ago where Michael Avenatti spoke. Seems like a long time ago now, but they're going to be a host of them. So it's going to be interesting to see how some of those folks go over with voters. Some of these people really have to hustle if they're going to continue.
And we should say, if people's interests were piqued by the hearing of that trailer, they should absolutely go wherever they find podcasts and subscribe to Stranglehold so that they can get the first episode right in their feed as soon as it's out in September. And if they have any questions about why New Hampshire's first or things they want to hear about, they should certainly reach out to us. We are quite easy to find.
Well, thank you both for being here today for the weekly news roundup for my debut here. It really was great to be joined by people who are following this so closely.
You crushed it, Case.
Thank you. Well, we hope to be back soon. That's it for today. Like Lauren said, make sure to check out your podcast feed for Stranglehold. You can watch this conversation on Facebook. We'll be posting the full video shortly. You can also hear it on our podcast or find it at nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. Our engineer is Dan Colgan. Thanks so much for making everything go smoothly today, Dan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Michael Brindley is our program manager. Our producers are Jessica Hunt and Christina Phillips. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord, and I'm Casey McDermott. Thanks so much for listening.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you liked what you heard, spread the word. Give us a review on Apple Podcasts to help other listeners find us. And thanks.